I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, and joined as always by John Rawling and Ian Dark. This week we're going to be talking about the life and times of the wonderful Joe Calzaghe, one of Britain's very finest fighters. John, so the Joe Calzaghe story, I mean, obviously he was a decorated amateur triple ABA champ. Did you know about him coming up?
Well, I have to confess, at that time, I wasn't a massive follower of the amateur sport. I was more sort of into the pro game, if you like. But, you know, we'd heard about him. We'd heard about how talented he was. And I remember first seeing him, and he was just head and shoulders above the opponents he was put in against early in his career. I think the first time I saw him live may have been when he fought Stephen Wilson and won the British title. And then I saw him again when he defeated Mark Delaney, which was when he retained that title. And it was just so obvious at that stage that this, you know, a totally unmarked lad. They always say respect a guy who's still got his looks. And he was sort of, he was just didn't look like a boxer one little bit. But he just clearly had so much talent. He just oozed it.
Yeah, that Mark Delaney fight, Mark was 21-0, and it was maybe not a 50-50, but it was supposed to be a good close clash anyway, a real sort of measuring stick. Ian, how about you? When was the first time you stumbled across Joe Calzaghe?
He's an interesting character, isn't he? I mean, I think it took him a decade to be an overnight sensation, to be honest with you, Joe. It took a long time for us, everybody, to really switch on to just how much talent he had. I mean, I watched him on some Mickey Duff undercards, and it was all quite low profile. We knew about his record as an excellent amateur and his ABA titles, and we knew that Mickey Duff had big plans for him, or so it seemed. But it all went on kind of in the background to whatever was the top of the bill at wherever they'd put him on, the Albert Hall or somewhere in those early days. He won nearly all those fights in the first or second round. Like John said, he was way too good. And you thought, well, we seem to have a talent here, but let's see when he's really, really tested. But, you know, John's right. When you think about it, he should have been even more of a megastar than he was, because he had those film star looks, didn't he? He could have walked straight into a Hollywood movie the way he looked. But I don't think Joe was ever that interested in stardom until quite late in his career.
Yeah, well, he had the most humble origins. You know, obviously, his dad was training him, and then they trained basically out of the shack in Wales. John, did you ever get down to that place?
I did, yeah. It wasn't exactly a palace, was it? And Enzo was the most remarkable character. I mean, as you say, he was brought up, Joe, in fairly poor circumstances. Enzo had been a sort of a jobbing busker. He'd come over from Sardinia, met Joe's mum, and eventually they'd moved down to South Wales, and they lived on a council estate down there in Newbridge. There was no, you know, sort of real money in the game. And Joe originally was a very talented young footballer, and he got into boxing. His dad wanted to get him into boxing because I think, well, Joe would tell you himself, he was bullied at school. I think possibly a little bit because of those Italian looks. And also, as a young lad, he was quite small and he was knocked around a bit when he went to when he went to senior school. And that's when he took up boxing. And of course, he found that he had a talent for it.
Yeah. I mean, his mum was a secretary, I think, at 20th Century Fox. I mean, you're right. Enzo was a barman, a chef, a cleaner. Do you remember he used to write songs and perform. Yeah. like you were saying before we came on air with this, John, I mean, he had that patois, that way of talking fast. He was from Sardinia, and you had to say, can you slow down a little bit? And so if you were recalling him to put him on the radio or television. But I went down there and there was that blue tumble down building, the Newbridge Rugby Club.
That's the one.
With the gym inside. I mean, nearly the whole of the inside of it was the ring. There wasn't room for an awful lot else. And you thought, well, how can a big star world champion be operating like this? But I think it kept him. I mean, he was totally ego-free, Joe. It was all really humble. And I think he was a simple soul as well. He went down, he did his training. He wanted to become one of the greatest British boxers ever, which, of course, he did. He put the work in and, you know, he kind of wasn't really in love with doing any great big hype or PR operation. He'd tell you like it was most of the time. I remember they invited him once in a kind of rare celebrity appearance to come and do something at some supermarket or other that they were doing some new branding or another. And in his speech, as he opened it, and he said, well, I just want to open the supermarket. Of course, I don't shop here myself. you know, he kind of didn't get it back then, really. But, you know, every time he got in the ring, he was usually pretty special. Not always, but mostly.
But, you know, I mean, looking back, Tris, from our perspective, if you're looking at it from a journalistic point of view, I mean, I think the tabloid boys used to find it a bit hard because he wasn't one to come out with the one-liners. He wasn't one to come out with the threats. As Ian said, he just traded on his ability. But the positive side of it was that, you know, I mean, you got some fighters who you'd turn up and they'd not be there. They'd keep you waiting when they finally spoke to you, they do it in a grudging manner. You know, I mean, to be quite honest, some of them could be absolute pains in the ass. But Joe was always available, always pleasant. And I can't remember in all the time and all the, I mean, God knows how many times I interviewed him over the years, over that long, long career. I can't remember one bad moment, Ian. I don't know about you. I mean, I really can't remember him being difficult.
No, it was great, actually. If you went down there, and I did a few times to do a few like preview films of fights with him down in Newbridge. I mean, you mentioned he was good at football. Well, I played a bit of football at half-decent sort of level, and I couldn't believe how good he was. He got the ball out. He was juggling it around. I mean, he loved Juventus. Every time they were on the TV, you know, you couldn't keep him away from watching Juventus. And I think, you know, as a little boy, you're right, he had dreams of being a professional footballer. And then they found out when his dad bought that speed ball or whatever it was for Christmas when he was about 8 or 9, they found out, crikey, he's something special. He's got something here as a boxer. So, you know, the football just became a secondary thing. But yeah, you're right. I mean, he was always, as I remember it, pretty amenable. I don't ever remember coming across him and him being in any way twisty or difficult.
And I suppose, In terms of making the right career choice, we really found out emphatically in October of 1997. And I think, Ian, you did this one for Sky Sports, when he toppled Chris Eubank in more ways than one. He toppled Eubank in seconds, didn't he? And then he went on and outlasted him in what was his first real gut check.
Yeah, I think it was one of many Sky Sports shows that they called Judgment Night. There seemed to be thousands of them. It wasn't even top of the bill. I think probably Nassim Hamid was top of the bill.
Yeah, it was Naz, wasn't it? Because it was in Sheffield then.
Oh, what an undercard fight. Joe Calzaghe beat Chris Eubank. All right, Eubank was a bit, you know, past his absolute peak years, but he was still, you know, one tough hombre. And, you know, what a sensation, really, Joe sort of leapt on him and put him down in the opening seconds of the fight. It was a, you know, sensational start. And he always said, didn't he, Joe? I mean, he went on to win it handily, but it was a tough fight. And he always said, until, I don't know if he meant this right at the end of his career, never asked him afterwards, but he always used to say, Chris Eubank, that was my toughest fight.
Yeah, and Chris Eubank as well, when he looked back at it, he would always say, yeah, he can really fight this man. And Chris has and had huge respect for Joe, you know, because he knows just how good he was. And people, do you remember when he was fighting, people used to say, oh, he's got no power, he just slaps, he pitter-pats. Well, I'll tell you what, if all he did was slap, he slapped bloody hard, because 32 out of those 46 wins came by stoppage. So you don't get that by pitter-pattering around.
Yeah, I think the thing was with that was, I don't think he was like a sledgehammer, lights-out puncher or anything like that. But what he had was tremendous timing and hand speed. Hand speed, that was the thing. If you say Joe Calzaghe to me and I'll say you got two words, I'd think straight away, fast hands. He had that blurring, bewildering speed, which most of his opponents, I think when it came down to it in the bigger fights, just struggled to cope with.
Yeah, I was with Roy Jones recently, and he was saying about Calzaghe's volume was what really set him apart. But obviously, there's no point having volume if you haven't got fast hands to get it off. I remember, Ian, from that Chris Eubank fight, that sort of nod of respect from Eubank when he got back to his feet. Do you remember that? It was quite an iconic look, really, when he half twigged, you know, this isn't going to be exactly the night I planned.
It was like the baton being passed a little bit, wasn't it? I think you're right, Tris, that was like a landmark, you know, light switch moment for, I think, maybe the British public even as well, who knew that Calzaghe was a talent. But here he was in with somebody everybody had heard of and knew their credentials. And he came out and he did that straight away. And I think everybody probably went, wow, we've got something.
Do you remember it was for the vacant WBO title? Because it was originally supposed to be Steve Collins, wasn't it? And Steve pulled out, was stripped of the title, and so the title declared vacant, and they went for it there. And, you know, I mean, Steve would probably tell you a different story, but I suspect and always suspected that, I mean, I was a massive Steve Collins admirer, hard man, very tough fighter, very good fighter, but I'm not sure in his heart of hearts that he fancied Calzaghe.
I think you're spot on. We'll probably have Steve on the phone the moment he hears this, if he does, and he'll probably give you a different version. But he knew what was what, didn't he, Steve Collins? You know, tremendous fighter. Shame we never saw that fight. It would have been great, wouldn't it? But yeah, I think he'd got the word and how good Calzaghe was going to be and how tough that was going to be. And I think he probably, deep in his heart, thought, no, thanks.
I think Joe ended up being the one with the target on his back, didn't he? Because obviously we're talking about him being a young pup here, targeting Steve Collins. And I think there was talk about Nigel Bennett at the time. And obviously he wound up fighting Eubank. More than a decade later, Joe was the one in the sights of the people like Carl Froch, James DeGale and George Groves and that lot coming through. Certainly Froch. I mean, that was one of the fights that people say is one of the great British fights to get away. But I'm not sure that they were ever quite at their peak at the same time.
It's a shame he wasn't really around in his peak years, you know, so there wasn't a thing like the Eubank and Ben and Watson era, or, you know, later on the guys you mentioned, you know, around Carl Froch. It's a shame that it was almost like an interregnum, but, you know, I think he ended up being the longest reigning super middleweight champion in history. He was the WBO champion for over 10 years and defended it, I think, 20 times. So there weren't many people in history who stacked up more defenses at any weight. I mean, I think Joe Lewis is the record at 25, isn't he, at heavyweight?
Yeah.
And then
you look back over those numerous defences, and as Ian alluded to earlier, there were a few of them which were fairly forgettable, Tris. You know, I mean, there are the standout performances, like when he blitzed Omar Sheikha, when he beat Charles Brewer, who was a very, very good fighter, and he beat him unanimously on points. And I think from probably the Welsh public's perspective, and maybe from our perspective, he'd beaten Eubank, he'd beaten Richie Woodall, etc. etc. But you remember in 2003 when the American Byron Mitchell came over and Joe gets put down early, and we're sort of thinking, whoa, what's happening here? And yes. he got up and absolutely blitzed him. It was a phenomenal performance. And I think, well, for me personally, that's when I looked at Joe Calzaghe and thought, wow, this guy really is something special. And that was the sort of the performance for me, which kind of pushed him into the superstar league. So you then got fights like Jeff Lacy, like Manfredo, like Kessler, which got huge crowds. And then he really was becoming a big box office star.
Yeah, you you mentioned that some of the defences were on the forgettable side. But I mean, that happens to any long reigning champion. There are going to be routine defences. Do you remember there was a guy called Will Kidfire McIntyre?
Yeah, I think that was on that Brian Nielsen undercard in Copenhagen, right?
I remember exactly that. Exactly on that one, Trish. You're right. But I remember we worked with Bob Mee, who was brilliant. Of course, you'll know him well, Trish, from all his work with Boxing News. Everybody in the business knows Bob. But he had a great line. He said, I think we should rename him Will Ceasefire McIntyre. I mean, Joe blew him away. And there was that guy, do you remember Tocker Pudwill, who he fought in Manchester, and who kind of was just a kind of chopping block for every single fighter that ever came through. You know, I mean, how he got in there to fight Joe in a world title fight, I have no idea, but you know, it happened. So you have to give him them. And John's mentioned some of the defenses he had. Yeah, the Mitchell one was thrilling, only two rounds of it. I mean, that second round, the way he responded to going down was electric. I did think the stoppage was probably a bit premature at the time.
Yeah, easy to forget as well that after a couple of his early defences, he fought Robin Reed, who gave him a very tough night in Newcastle.
And they never wanted a rematch. It was a close one, that. Robin yeah. thought he'd won it. I remember commentating on that one, and I did actually score it narrowly. And I mean, you know, literally only by a round or two in Joe's favour. It was a tight one. And I think it speaks volumes, really. They could have done a rematch, couldn't they? And they never did. So yeah. they knew that Robin at that time was a really good fighter. And it was a tough night for Joe, that one. Arguably one of the hardest fights of his entire career.
I think it was probably the closest he came to getting beaten, wasn't it, against Robin Reed? I mean, we were all wondering at the end, it could go either way. This two of the judges had it 116-111 for Reed, for Calzaghe, and the other one had it 116-111 for Reed. I mean, how they worked out that they've got somebody winning the thing by 5 points, I've no idea. It was a close-run thing. You know, you wouldn't argue either way, but, you know, I think Robin Reed proved something, didn't he? That night.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was Joe's hands were busted up though that night. I remember sitting in the hotel with him afterwards, and he sat down with a drink alongside us, and his hand was really wrapped up in all kinds of stuff. So I think he was suffering bad hands after that. I think he had intermittently bad hand problems through his career, didn't he?
He did. Can you remember how you scored that one, Ian? Because, I mean, there were a lot of really close rounds. And you know how scoring goes. If you've got tight rounds, then you can have a big disparity in the scores. And it sounds ludicrous that one's 116-11 one way and the other's 116-11 the other way. But can you remember how you scored it, how you had it at ringside?
Well, don't get me started on scoring controversies. We'll be here all night.
That's another programme.
No, I mean, to be honest with you, John... Is 25 years ago? No, I don't. I thought it was close. I remember thinking it was close, and it wasn't Joe's best night, that one. It was as close as he got. It probably just damaged his reputation a little bit that it had been so much of a, you know, on the brink sort of decision.
Well, do you remember this, Ian? I mean, two fights on from that. I mean, his reputation was hardly enhanced. He beat a very good operator by the name of David Starry, but they had a very drab fight on the undercard of Mike Tyson against Julius Francis at the MEN. And I think there were boos and, you know, it was awful. It was a platform for Joe to really show his skills, and it alienated a lot more people. So this, you know, he made becoming an overnight success go a long way away. You know, people were starting to switch off, weren't they, at this point?
Yeah, I think that's right. There were nights like those that meant he didn't really excite the Fleet Street sports editors and the media in general. So although he was this long reigning champion, there wasn't that kind of heat and electricity you got surrounding, say, Prince Nassim Hamed. So it was never like that for him. As I said, I think right at the start of our broadcast, it took a long time before everybody looked at his career as a whole and realised, you know, that he was one of the greatest British boxers that ever lived.
I'll just put this out there. I mean, at the time we're talking about, Frank Warren, the star of Frank Stable, who was bursting through, was Ricky Hatton, wasn't it? Mm. He was the one who was who's really getting that fanatical following up in Manchester. And there was an element, I think, of when Hatton moved away and did his own thing, moved away from Frank Warren, that is. Frank needed a marquee fighter. And so he put all the promotional muscle behind Joe. And that's when, you know, that's when he was propelled towards that phenomenal fight against Jeff Lacy. That night, he was just out of this world. Absolutely brilliant.
Well, if you remember, Jeff Lacy was the betting favourite, wasn't he?
Was.
For that.
Yeah,
the American writers, and they tended to, at that era, they tended to write off British boxers generally. I mean, it took them a long time to realise that Lennox Lewis was any good. I mean, somebody called him grape juice passed off as fine wine and stuffed with old newspapers with old news in if you cut him open. And it was bad stuff, but, you know, they thought Lacy was some kind of super middleweight Tyson, didn't they? He was unbeaten, HBO money behind him, on the verge of superstardom. He was going to come in here and just blow Joe Calzaghe away. Well, you know, given Joe's mentality, tell him a fight, you know, ahead of time where people are saying, oh, you know, you're going to lose this, you're going to be put in your place. I think that really put him right on his mettle. He was absolutely electric that night. He just took Lacy apart. He didn't just win every round of the fight. I think he had a point deduction maybe in one of the rounds, but he not only won every round, he won every second of every round. He was absolutely phenomenal.
I remember Showtime came across and they were doing that fight, weren't they? And they were interviewing sort of the British journalists and punters and commentators. Maybe they interviewed you as well, Ian. But I remember they put a microphone in front of my face and they were asking, you know, they were expecting me to say, oh, Lacy this, Lacy that. And I said, no. I said, Joe Calzaghe is going to hit Jeff Lacy three times while Jeff Lacy is thinking about what to do. And for that reason, he's going to win. And he's not going to win just, he's going to win big time. And they looked at me as though I was mad.
Yeah.
You know, I remember it clearly. They said, do you really believe that? And yeah. I said, yeah, absolutely. Because I remember Lacy came over. Did he fight in a contest? He fought somebody or other up in Newcastle, didn't he? Mm-hmm. And I remember watching it with Frank Warren. And Frank said to me, this guy is absolutely made for Joe. Because he didn't have the speed to go with him. He wasn't as big a puncher as people thought. And of course, defensively, Joe just absolutely schooled him. He pierced his defences. And as Ian said, that night, he was just stunning. That was a brilliant, brilliant performance.
The fans were chanting, easy, easy. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
In the background, big chants ringing around the arena. And something I read about that fight was that Sugar Ray Leonard was watching it on television back home in America. And he said, do you know what? I didn't really know very much about Joe Calzaghe before I'd heard of him. After two rounds, I was a fan. I was standing in front of my TV shouting, wow, look at this guy.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's some tribute.
It is, Joe would have loved that, wouldn't he?
We mentioned Ben Collins and Eubank at the start, or, you know, a little while ago. There was actually something that Nigel Benn told me once, and he is full of so much admiration for Calzaghe. He thinks Calzaghe would have cleaned out their era as well, and said that definitively, which is high praise indeed. And I think, obviously, when you look at that Jeff Lacy performance, when you talk about signature performances, it's not just a signature performance of Joe Calzaghe. It's a signature performance from any British fighter in any era, if you're going to stand them up against the great performances. And I think it's interesting, obviously, guys, you mentioned that the Americans were sold on Lacy, even if you weren't, John. But I mean, Steve Bunce never lets Boxing News forget it, but Boxing News picked Lacy and plenty, you know, I think the vast majority did. And certainly what even the smartest person couldn't have predicted was exactly how emphatic it was going to be. I mean, Lacey was never the same again. He ruined him.
I think he lost again, didn't he? Three fights later. I mean, I'd seen Lacey a couple of times in America when they were kind of manufacturing him and trying to turn him into the big name. And I mean, this isn't being wise after the event. I wasn't that sold on him, really, if I'm honest with you. I mean, nobody ever asked me for a tip for that fight. I wasn't commentating on it. But I think I would have been with John, and this isn't just hindsight. I think I would have leant towards Calzaghe because I hadn't really been that electrified by what I'd seen of Lacey. I think basically he was a bit of a myth, truth to tell. I mean, he was good. But yeah, I never thought he was all that.
Joe ruined him. He ruined him. You know, yeah. I mean, when you look back, if you look back and watch that fight, what were Lacey's corner? What was his manager? What were they doing? Those last three or four rounds, he was getting an absolute pasting every second, Dean said. And, you know, surely they should have compassionately said, right, boy, you've had enough. You know, let's get you out of there.
Well, you've hit on a huge whole subject there, which we could probably do a whole podcast alone about, you know, the work of cornermen. A corner's job is to save their fighter for another day, isn't it? When once any chance has gone, and any chance had long gone in that fight. So they needed to take him out of there and said, okay, tonight's not his night. He's out of his depth with this guy. We can rebuild it and go again. But really, it was such a systematic beating that effectively he couldn't go again afterwards.
Yeah, John, and I don't know if you remember, there was an issue beforehand where was it Joe wanted to pull out because of his hand, and Enzo told him to get his head in the game and to go through with it.
Yeah, both Enzo and Frank gave him, you know, read him the riot act, as I remember, and said, look, you know, this is your big night. This is the one, because this was a big fight in the States as well as over here. It's one which was actually making him a transatlantic star. And both Enzo, his dad, and Frank said, you know, come on, you've got to get out there. You've got to take this one because, as I said before, this one is absolutely made for you and you can win it. You have to win it. And he went out and did it. But yeah, there were those moments of insecurity with Joe, and his hand weakness was a persistent thing which haunted him throughout his career. And but can you imagine if he hadn't taken that? Maybe after that, maybe Kessler would never have happened, you know, and the other big fights.
And I think really the American view of that would have been a cynical view that he dodged the fight. He didn't fancy it. That's what they'd have said, even if the injury was genuine. So it was probably wise advice. And they probably knew, too, that he was more or less good to go, as he proved in pretty emphatic fashion.
Enzo wasn't afraid of telling him, you know, in pretty emphatic terms on occasion. Enzo Macronelli told me the once that up at the rugby club, he'd been through, it might have been in the run-up to this fight, he'd had one particularly sort of desultory sparring session and he'd just been really going through the motions and he didn't look like he was doing. And Enzo came out and he said, call yourself a fucking champ. You look like a fucking chump. That was rubbish. You know, and going and I'm not going to try and do the Italian accent, but he was coming on to him with that sort of stuff. And he wasn't afraid to tell Joe in no uncertain terms when he thought that he wasn't producing. And, you know, Joe, when you talk about the influence of his father, there was a lot of criticism, if you remember, Ian, wasn't there, about Enzo? People said, oh, he's rubbish on the pads. He just pushes the pads towards the punches. He doesn't go through good moves because he doesn't know them. He's not good at binding hands. He's tactically not very good. But Joe would always say that was absolute crap. He said people who said that didn't understand the relationship between me and my father, because he could spur me along and he could inspire me at times when I needed it, as no other person could have done.
Yeah, well, he understood him back to front, didn't he? But they did have some ferocious rows along the way, but that was all just part of producing him to be at his best on fight nights. And I think probably, Joe, given his character, he probably did need that kick up the backside from time to time. Maybe he did get a bit bored. Maybe it was all a bit routine. I think maybe there was, though he never really said it publicly, I did sometimes feel there was a little bit of resentment that he wasn't quite, you know, his name wasn't in lights in the same way that some other fighters were.
I mean, it's easy to forget as well, when we talk about Enzo, he didn't just train Joe. I mean, he had an absolute booming stable around 2007 when Gavin Rees became world champion, Enzo Macconelli became a world champion, Nathan Cleverley became a world champion. There was Bradley Price, there was Harry Miles. These guys were a problem for a lot of fighters. Enzo wasn't just a Joe Calzaghe guy. He had a very good stable there for a serious amount of time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for somebody who supposedly didn't know what he's doing, that's quite a resume, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a terrific lineup. And yeah, there was that tendency to kind of deride the operation, as people do with father and son operations, that there was something maybe a little bit amateurish about it, that maybe the trainer wasn't the real deal, or he was just jumping in on the success of his son and living the life, you know, and this getting the stardom and reflected glory. But I think he proved, those other fighters you've mentioned, that he could train a fighter, he understood style, he understood strategy.
Well, Enzo wasn't that sort of bloke anyway, Ian, was he? I mean, no. there was never the big I am about him. I mean, he was as mad as a hatter, wasn't he? I mean, he was great fun to be. He was great fun to be around. I mean, if you went for dinner with Enzo, he'd be the life and soul, and he wouldn't you know, sort of let minutes go without having a big smile on his face or a story from somewhere about what's been going on or about what he thought. And you can really understand the bond that there was between Joe and Enzo, and why it hurt Joe so very deeply when he died relatively young.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned going for dinner with him. You wouldn't have got a word in edgeways. I mean, he never finished his meal, would he, Enzo? He just talked non-stop, you know, from the moment you arrived. You know, gabbled away, but there were some gems in there, and you know, what a team they turned out to be.
Well, I would always say, you know, Enzo was one of the guys that would phone up the boxing news office, and if he felt that one of his fighters didn't get a fair shake, then he would let us know. And I always had a lot of time and respect for the people that did that, you know, whether it was Jim Evans or a Brendan Ingle, because it showed they cared, right? And the fighters put so much into their careers and so much into their fights that you want these people to have their best interests at heart. And the ones that phoned up always stayed with me, in the sense that these are the guys that, you know, even if it was just a 3-paragraph write-up on one of their fighters, if they didn't think we'd been fair-handed, then they wanted us to know for next time. And I always had a lot of respect for Enzo for doing that, whether it was a 4-round fighter or his son. I think one of the things that was interesting as well about Enzo is not just that he was getting criticism for being, in inverted commas, amateurish or being Joe's dad, but, you know, there was very serious talks, I believe, about, you know, Joe being almost persuaded to change his trainer, right, John?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was. Yeah. It's not just. This is not just tittle tattle from us. This was absolutely genuine. You know. I mean, there were people who would whisper saying, "But you know, all this hand problems that Joe had was down to the fact that his hands weren't bound properly." That was the theory, and that strategically, tactically, Enzo, for all the fact he got these good fighters, he didn't really have it. Now that, you know, I mean, that's manifestly rubbish from what Joe went on to produce. But that, yeah, at one stage, there were very definite talks behind the scenes and little bits of pressure being put here and there on Joe, saying, maybe it's time to have a change. Maybe it's time to go a different way. I'm glad he did.
Where was that pressure coming from? Who was saying that? Was that just media talk, or was that from actually inside the camp or even the promotional company?
I think it would have been inside the camp, but I think it would probably, without sort of getting too specific about it, because I don't want to get up on the end of a legal action or something, but I think it's fair to say that there was a bit of pressure within the promotional camp. They weren't sure at one stage where Joe was going. They thought that he was underperforming at one point. You know, by the time he fought Lacey, of course, this thought was had well gone. But around the time, say when he was struggling against somebody like David Starry, I think at that point, you know, there was a feeling, maybe, is this right? Does Enzo know enough? And I heard it said, definitely. And thankfully, Joe stuck with his dad and the rest is history.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't imagine him, really, could you, going to Las Vegas, say, or Los Angeles and training with Freddie Roach, that kind of thing that some fighters go for. You just can't imagine that Joe Calzaghe would have been the same fighter if he wasn't at home in South Wales, in Newbridge, going down that little blip to that little blue tumble down hut, doing the training like he always did, going home, watching Juventus on the TV,
running the Welsh hills and doing all that. Yeah.
I mean, that was him. And I think if you'd taken that away from him, you'd have got something less.
I don't think he'd have even been happy if somebody had said, right, let's get you down to London and base you with one of the prominent London trainers. You know, because you remember when he had to do a press conference up in London. You know, I mean, he'd almost have a nosebleed when he crossed the Severn Bridge, wouldn't he? He didn't like coming over to England particularly. He was never happier than when he was among his own people in the little community where he'd grown up and where he was just massively admired.
I mean, he was homespun, but he did become a celebrity, didn't he? Really, that Jeff Lacey fight just moved him onto another level. He won the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, didn't he? So he did then get that crossover appeal late in his career. He became that star. He was on Strictly, all that kind of thing. So who'd have thought that, you know, way back when we were just going down to South Wales and it was all pretty low profile?
And the big fights in the fag end of his career, but the big fights there, Manfredo, big, massive crowd watching that. Kessler, what was it, 50-odd thousand at the Millennium Stadium. And then moving on to the final career-closing fights against Bernard Hopkins and Roy Jones Jr. You know, I remember that night at the Millennium Stadium, and you looked around, and the place was absolutely buzzing for that Kessler fight. And that was a terrific fight, by the way, as well, because Kessler then was in his prime. And I think it was a better Kessler then than the Kessler who fought Karl Froch later in his career. I think Kessler at that stage, and he had two versions of the title, if you remember. So it was a big unification battle. And that was a terrific performance from Joe, because midway through the fight, I'm sure Tris would remember this, Joe was kind of struggling a bit, and tactically he changed his approach. He moved away from the original blueprint and found a different way of going through the gears and eventually winning the fight pretty emphatically. It was a really good tactical performance from Joe.
Yeah, and he hurt Kessler to the body in that one as well. I remember being ringside and hearing Kessler groan from a body shot, and you started to think the tide was going to turn, and as you say, John, it did really. And it was an amazing night. It was, you know, as Ian said at the top, really, about being an overnight success and it taking 10 years. That was the night, really, when the success sort of all, you could see it, you know, it was there. It was physically there, 50,000 people at home, a good share of Viking fans there as well for Kessler. I remember, you know, seeing the streets of Cardiff with people with their Viking helmets and different things. And like you said, John, as well, really, I think Kessler was probably at the top of his game then. He'd unified, he traveled, he picked up the belts from decent champions, and he'd done it in style. And he came over with this fantastic reputation. And really, Joe was, I don't know if I could say another level up, but, you know, he was certainly too good on that night. And they've got this deep friendship now.
I think Mogens Paller, who was Kessler's promoter, put a big wedge of cash into the fight to make it happen. And Kessler came absolutely. He was absolutely spot on. You know, you know, don't you, Ian? When you interview an athlete and you talk to a sportsman, you can kind of see in their body and in their eyes when they're absolutely right. And Kessler was. He had that fantastic sheen about him, if you like, on his skin and in his whole demeanor. He was there to win. He really fancied that he was going to beat Joe.
He did, yeah. And he was a quality fighter and a quality guy out of the ring as well. I mean, everything was good about that night. It was spectacular and a privilege and pleasure to be around that fight. Joe had to be at his very best. I mean, how often does it happen? It happens too often in boxing that we see a big fight really when the two fighters are past their best, like, you know, the Lennox Lewis, Mike Tyson thing. You can think of Mayweather Pacquiao, happened too late. Here were two fighters bang on song, you know, like Leonard and Hearns in 1981, you know, that showdown fight where these two were right at that peak moment. So that made it something special as well.
Yeah, it was great. Everything paid off for Joe that night. And obviously he became unified champ, adding the WBA and WBC titles to his WBO title. Gents, I just wanted to rewind slightly. Maybe we can come back to Kessler in a sec. But when we were talking there about Enzo and the possibility of Joe being asked to look elsewhere for another trainer, or being recommended maybe it was an addition to the team, just another pair of eyes, but whatever was going on. We've obviously had these discussions talking about Mike Tyson and Naz. And really, that was a fork in the road where Naz left Brendan Ingle and things didn't work out, where Tyson left Kevin Rooney and things didn't work out. Imagine if Joe had left Enzo. There's no telling where it could have gone, because like you said, Ian, really, in terms of style, personality, location, there's just nothing else that you think could imagine would have worked with Joe.
Yeah, I mean, it was a chemistry, wasn't it, between those two. And, you know, if there were those talks, and it's only our speculation that, but there certainly were those kind of whispers around, you know, whether Enzo really was going to be the guy for Joe when he moved up to the higher echelons and in the big fights that were going to have a high profile in America. I mean, I don't know how far those talks got, but I would suspect when push came to shove, it would have been Joe himself who said, yeah, "No, not having this. This isn't going to happen." And you're right. You can only speculate what would have happened to his career had he gone off in another direction with, you know, a Freddie Roach or Manny Stewart or whoever. But, you know, I think it was good that he stayed with Dab, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, one of my career highs was being at the International Boxing Hall of Fame when Joe was inducted and Enzo was there. And I managed to spend a good portion of that weekend with them. And it was amazing. I remember Ed Robinson got this great bit on a Sky package with, basically he was interviewing Joe, and Joe had a great class to go in with. I think he went in with De La Hoya and Trinidad. So some very high profile guys. It was a great class to go in with. And Ed pulled Joe to one side or Joe and Enzo to one side. And he put the microphone in front of Enzo's face, and Enzo, for the first time in his life, couldn't get a word out for the tears. He was so proud and so overwhelmed by it all. And I guess it was vindication, not just for Joe to be recognized there, but for Enzo to, I know Enzo wasn't inducted, but for his achievements, the fact that Joe had stuck with him and that they'd done it together as a team. You can't imagine as a dad what that must mean, can you? You can't, because so few people would ever experience that.
And he was such an emotional guy as well, coming from Sardinia. What you saw was what you got. If he felt something, there'd be tears of joy or maybe of frustration. And like you said, Tris, if he wasn't happy with something you'd written, he wasn't going to keep that to himself. He was going to get on the phone and tell you about it. So, I mean, that made him extremely likable as well. So, yeah,
sure.
I remember that interview well, Triz. I remember seeing that. I wasn't at the, you know, I mean, you were there, so you remember it more vividly, I guess. But I remember seeing it, and the emotion between Joe and Enzo was just lovely to see. You know, I mean, it was a fantastic father-son relationship, and they'd done it as a sporting team. And that was the moment, I think, that for all the question marks that had been raised maybe in the past, which we've alluded to, that was the moment when Joe and Enzo were there in front of their peers, rightly getting the acclaim that they deserved. And, you know, I was delighted to see it. And it was just lovely to see the pure affection between father and son.
And then following the Kessler fight, obviously you mentioned that he went on to America, and he had, you know, for the Yanks have been saying, oh, he's not fought in America, he's not fought the top Americans. So he goes to America and he fights these top Americans. He fights Bernard Hopkins and a Roy Jones who's on the downside. A Hopkins who still had plenty of miles left on the clock, as we later find out. And obviously going into that fight, that was when Hopkins said that he told the world that he wouldn't lose to a white man, right?
Yeah, not very impressive, was it? I really hate hearing that sort of thing. It was naked racism, and yeah, that was not clever. And I think Bernard Hopkins, I don't know whether he regretted that saying that afterwards, but I thought that was just as bad as what was supposedly said by Alan Minter all those years ago before his fight against Marvin Hagler. You know, there's no place for that in sport.
It was crass and repulsive. And I remember when I heard that, I thought, did he really say that? What century is he from? What an incredibly stupid thing to say.
And then, well, obviously, we're used to Joe having these quick starts and he comes out of the blocks, but he gets put over by Hopkins in the first round. And, you know, that maybe that was a warning that maybe Joe was nearing the end of the line.
Joe wasn't the fighter that he had been 2 or 3 years ago, I don't think. He wasn't the same fighter who'd fought Jeff Lacy, you know, and it happens to all sportsmen. There comes a point when the, you know, the sands of time start to take a bit of a toll.
Yeah, there was always a bit of a row afterwards, wasn't there? Certainly from the Hopkins camp, saying, yeah, we won the fight. You know, I always felt I made him fight my fight. I always thought I was in control of it. But, you know, HBO, I think, was it old Harold Lederman? I think he had it 116, 111 to Joe. And Joe said it wasn't his best night, but he definitely won the fight. So, yeah, it was one of those late career things. It was, you know, probably happened all too late, but I thought he won it handily enough.
Hopkins tried to old man him, didn't he? He tried all the old tricks, trying to buy a bit of time, as you say, make him fight his fight, tried to slow him down, tried to hold him, tried to maul him. And it was fairly obvious to those of us who watched plenty of boxing what was going on. He was trying everything possible not to engage with Joe Calzaghe. And I agree. I had Calzaghe winning the fight, but it was by no means emphatic.
So he had his big night in Vegas, and then he has a big night in the Garden. And we talked about Collins, Eubank and Ben, and Roy Jones was really of that era. And he fights Joe in November of 2008. And Joe, I think, will concede that Roy wasn't the Roy of old, but he also wasn't the old Roy that would be fighting years and years on. But Joe was down in the first, and he has subsequently said and told me that, you know, to be down twice in two fights, first round both times, that was an alarm bell. 46-0, and you know, you've been put down twice, is now the time to get out. Ian, what's your take on that Roy Jones fight? I mean,
maybe there was something of a slow starter. It wasn't slow against Eubank, was he? It was the other way around. But, you know, he was down in the first round against Byron Mitchell, against Hopkins and against Jones. But, you know, like John said, maybe it was a sign that there a certain level of vulnerability was beginning to creep in, as it does for anybody who's fought at the top level for as long as he had. Plus he's upper weight, isn't he? It's all happening at a higher weight than his peak years at super middle. So, it's kind of getting near the end of the line. But I think what we're really talking about here is, and what was important for Joe is, because those were such big, mega money-making fights in America, it was Joe cashing in his chips, wasn't it, really? At the end of his career, he would have hopefully put an awful lot of money in the bank from those big American occasions against Bernard Hopkins and Roy Jones Jr.
Well, people looked at those fights, didn't they? And I've heard people say, you know, did he really need to take those? You know, was it not, in a sense, damaging the legacy somewhat, and I'd defend him every step of the way. You know, he paid his dues. He'd been around for a long, long time, and to have two big paying fights, as Ian said, two big paying fights at that stage, Tris, absolutely, absolutely right. Go and get it. And I think sensibly, having got those out of the way, money in the bank, I think he made the right decision by leaving it there and walking away as an undefeated legend. And not too many fighters have done that. 46-0, that is an astonishing record.
I think under 20 people, Tris might know this better than me, have retired as undefeated world champions at any weight. So
it's an extraordinary short list, isn't it? It really is. And like you say, I mean, to get to 46-0, it's something else. One thing I wanted to, I mean, it's only a hypothetical, really. And Ian, I'll put it to you, but imagine if that Lacey fight had come 5 years earlier.
Yeah, well, Lacey, Lacey would have been beaten then as well, I think, to be honest with you.
But I mean, in terms of Joe's legacy, because after that Lacey fight, there was only really a handful of fights. It was five fights after that: Beaker, Manfredo, Kessler, Hopkins, and Jones. And so obviously those are the fights where he really, like John said, was able to sort of cash in. But it took him a long time to get that big fight to make him that overnight success.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very slow-burning career. I think he would agree with that. And maybe he was a little frustrated by that others seemed to be getting the big headlines and maybe the bigger money. I don't know about that side of it. But, you know, he got there in the end. I think that's the key thing, isn't it, with Joe? He went and proved it. And the Americans, who were cynical about what he was, they were won over by what happened against Jeff Lacey. You know, the Sugar Ray Leonard story that I've told you just symbolizes all of that. So in the end, he was able to bask in a fantastic kind of glory and afterglow at the end of his career. Everybody realized, hey, we had something extremely good in Joe Calzaghe. He's right there, really, in the argument for among the best pound-for-pound fighters these islands have ever produced.
I think he was right not to be lured back to fight Carl Froch as well, because I think very, very strongly that a peak Joe Calzaghe would have beaten Carl Froch at his best. But by that stage, you know, the evidence was there that he wasn't the fighter that he once was. And to have come back and fought Carl Froch, well, it might have been a big moneymaker. It might have been a big commercial event. But I don't think it would have proved all that much, because Calzaghe was not at his best by that stage. And I wouldn't have liked him to have seen him struggle against a man, you know, at that stage, having done what he'd done.
It's a brave decision, isn't it, always, though, to retire. It's okay for media guys like us to say, well, you know, the time's come. You've got to knock it on the head. It's easy to just pick up the phone one more time and somebody offers you a few million dollars to fight again to go, all right, well, you know, one more time and top up the account. So Joe had the common sense, I think, to end it when he did. Yeah, that would have been a very dangerous fight for him, I think, to have taken Froch at that late stage, right at the tail end of his career. And, you know, it's a fight he probably could have been beaten in because of the fact that he had too much wear and tear by then.
And, John, I mean, there was nothing left to prove, though, was there?
No. You look, if you're analysing the whole of Joe's career and you look at his record and you set it against anybody else in the history of the British sport, he has to be right up there as arguably the best pound-for-pound fighter that's ever come out of these islands. He was fantastic to watch at his best. He was a gentleman. He doesn't leave the sport, or he didn't leave the sport with regrets, I don't think. I don't think he left the sport having upset or irritated people. He always conducted himself in a manner befitting a champion. And I thought he was terrific. And, you know, in the time I've been involved in boxing, which is, well, a long time now, and Joe, for me, is absolutely up there. You know, maybe Lennox Lewis as a heavyweight, he'd stand comparison, but there are not too many others. He was an exceptional talent.
Like his book said, no ordinary Joe.
Correct.
Definitely. And then I mentioned the chat I had with Roy Jones recently talking about Joe. And one of the things that Roy did actually, which you guys would like to hear, I'm sure, was that he gave Enzo his flowers and said, you know, this was a really good trainer. And, you know, he'd never, you know, not boxed, didn't have a great experience or anything like that. But what he did with Joe stands the test of time. And it's extraordinary, isn't it? Absolutely extraordinary. I mean, you can't put it into words, you know, a dad taking his son down to basically a hut and carving out a Hall of Fame career worth millions, that winding up in Las Vegas and Madison Square Garden. It's fantasy stuff, isn't it?
And rightly, he's become a massive, massive hero in Welsh sport and still commands astonishing respect to this day.
I think he has the freedom of Caerphilly, doesn't he? All that kind of thing. He's CBE, and yeah, I mean, they love him. Of course they do, and they should.
And then obviously I mentioned that Joe's good friends with Kessler these days. He's actually got a very weird and unusual friendship with Chris Eubank. And I say weird and unusual just because they're two people that you wouldn't put together. I mean, I couldn't imagine sitting at a dinner table with Eubank and Calzaghe at the same time. But because of that, what they shared in 1997, they still have this utmost reverence with one another. Ian, can you imagine being a fly on the wall when Joe and Chris Eubank get together?
I would like to be a fly on the wall when Chris Eubank got together with anybody, to be honest with you. he really was a one-off. But yeah, I mean, it's that fusion of spirit, isn't it? Which is lovely to see between fighters who've shared a ring and maybe have shared something spectacular in that ring. I think as Calzaghe and Eubank did that night, you know, Joe saying Chris was his toughest ever opponent, you know, and maybe that was still true right to the end, even though he'd fought the likes of Lacey and Jones and Hopkins and Kessler and whatever. So, yeah, that's lovely. I do think, you know, something Joe said, don't want to really raise the subject or make a lot of it, because he did have that thing where he admitted the occasional use of cocaine, didn't he? And said at the time, you know, in what's been my occasional use of cocaine in what have seemed the long days of my retirement. So I think it's hard for any sportsman who's been as, you know, as brilliant as Joe was, or really any professional sportsman, you know, how do they cope with that life when they're not up there with their name in lights anymore and those long years?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting with that, Ian, in particular, is with Joe, you got someone who retired on his own terms and he still struggled. You know, a lot of these guys go out on a loss or they go out defeated and, you know, their career in so many ways is taken away from them because they're no longer what they were. Joe went out on his own terms and still missed the buzz, the routine and discipline and everything that comes from a career in boxing. So I think it's right to highlight that because, you know, I think it's not enough is done to help these guys bridge that life from, you know, being a professional athlete to a guy who's still got 50 years ahead of them as a regular civilian. John, sorry, I cut you off there.
No, it's not at all. It just reminded me of a quote I saw years ago. It might have been Norman Giller's book, but it was from Jimmy Greaves, who, as we all know, descended into alcoholism in the later stages of his career. He had a TV career when he managed to come to terms with that, dry himself out and become the lovable personality who became a televised star. But Jimmy went at one point, he said, you know, when people finish as a sportsman, when footballers retire, they should be just led away and shot.
Well, thank God they didn't come to that. Yeah, I mean, that's a whole book and another subject. What do you do when, you know, with the rest of your life if you've been a superstar at, you know, 18 to 25?
Well, yeah. He tried to promote, didn't he? He tried to promote and he tried to act, and neither of them have borne success. So, you know, you can understand that maybe he did feel a bit empty, and you're looking for that extra thrill, which wrongly, of course, he thought that cocaine might have brought him.
Yeah,
and I think there's a couple of things to look at here. Is Joe lives a very nice, quiet life now. I went to his house a year or two ago, And I'm in touch with Joe regularly, and he just lives a very quiet and unassuming life. He's got a couple of French bulldogs that he worships and takes them out for walks. And I also think it's really important to talk about his sons, Joe Jr. and Connor, who he is desperate to be a role model for. And you can see their relationship on social media and what they mean to each other. And obviously how they've pulled Joe through this extraordinary hard time, not just where he lost his father, Enzo, but where he lost his mum in a short time afterwards as well. He's been through an absolute maelstrom of grief the last few years, and my heart goes out to him. Sorry?
Okay, Joe's okay.
Yeah, I think he's okay. I don't think he'll ever get over the loss of his parents, though. And I think it's been, you know, and it's been heartbreaking. I went to Enzo's funeral, actually, and it was one of the hardest things I've been to. And how anyone managed to keep, well, no one really did manage to keep it together. It was brutal. It was a very, very difficult day. And I think that's one of the reasons why Joe has a quiet life. He has his quiet days and he has his memories, and he likes to travel with his boys and spend a lot of time with his family. And he's become a granddad recently as well. So there's a sign, a sure sign that we're all getting old.
frightening. Joe Calzaghe, a granddad, you know. I mean, you start to, as a commentator, you start to realise you've been around a while when you have a career begin and a career end. And yeah, people say, oh, that was a fantastic long career. Look how well he fought and how long he fought. And Ian and I covered pretty much the whole lot from beginning to end. And here we are, how many years later, after the retirement, we're talking 14 years on and still remembering him as though it was yesterday. And he's a granddad, eh?
He's a fighter.
Well, Ricky's a granddad now as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I am, yeah. Sure. But yeah, I remember fighters kept coming up to me and saying, oh, I used to listen to you when I was a little boy. They're 25 now and, you know, they're unbeaten in 30 fights. So. Oh, my God. No.
It's great stuff. No, I said that Ricky Hatton has become a granddad as well. So, you know, it's that era. They're all. And, you know, Joe's sons, I think, dabbled with fighting, but I don't think they're actually training guys in Newbridge. So they're doing well and they're still passionate about the sport. And obviously we know what Ricky's son, Campbell, is doing as well. So it's great to see. Gents, this has been a lot of fun. Sorry, Ian, any closing thoughts, Ian?
He's on the telly. I bet he is, isn't he? Football.
Who's that? Who's that?
He's still watching Juventus play every time they're on.
Oh, yes, with the boys as well. The boys are Juventus fans. John, any closing thoughts on Joe Calzaghe?
Well, just finally from me, just briefly looking back, you know, what a privilege it was to see such a great boxer, such a great fighter for so many years. He was, was lucky to have the microphone in my hand.
Yeah. I mean, I just add to all that. I think he's rightly revered and respected throughout world boxing and extremely fondly remembered.
Great, gents. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure as always, and we will be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.